Well, we're back, folks. Good morning. This is Talking About the Law. And again, I have the very good fortune of having Carmen Durso, who is an expert attorney on areas of sexual abuse, especially child sexual abuse. And when we left off, we were talking about claims against schools, and I'm assuming primarily public schools. What about private schools? Is there any difference?
Well, they're not subject to the Tort Claims Act. Simple negligence is a basis for suit there, but they are also, to the extent they receive federal money, are also subject to Title IX. Interestingly, the private schools are primarily where I've been seeing cases involving female teachers abusing young boys. And I can't tell you why that's the case, but I have had five of those cases in the past 2 years, which is unusual.
Do most private schools receive federal funds?
Well, some do, some don't. I came across one private school that was founded in the 1930s, and they apparently set themselves up because they didn't want to have anything to do with the government, so that every single dollar in that school, including the monies paid for scholarships and that sort of thing, came from private funds. But if a school has federal funding in any way, for example, loans that are used for students to pay tuition, then the Office for Civil Rights and the Department of Education takes the position that they're subject to Title IX as well.
Now, one other area that most of the public is now very well aware of course, is clergy sexual abuse. And it includes not only priests, but rabbis, ministers, all you know, it runs the gamut. What are the rights that injured people have against those institutions?
Well, you're quite correct. I've had cases involving a number of different religions. You know, there's an unfortunate tendency to say, well, you're being an anti-Catholic going after Catholic priests. In this part of the country, Catholic churches are the largest churches, but you get to other parts of the countries and you'll find that there are Baptist churches that are the big churches in those areas, and they're having the same problems that the Catholic churches are. But in Massachusetts, we have a peculiar law that is only in effect in a few states, and that's called charitable immunity.
What is that?
That's a law which limits the liability of the charitable institution to a small amount of money, in this case $20,000. Prior to 1971, they were totally immune, but since 1971, the amount of money that you can recover against a Catholic church is $20,000, and a number of the dioceses strictly impose that limit. Let me tell you just what that means, too, for your listeners. If you went to trial against a diocese because a priest had sexually abused a parishioner, and you got a verdict for $1 million, the judge would thank the jury, send them home, and reduce that amount to $20,000. Regardless of what the case was about, simply because that law protects these institutions.
Now, in terms of that law, in terms of settlement and resolution, is there a way to get cases resolved so that the plaintiff or the injured person does not have to go to court and run that risk?
Sure. What we found out in the Boston Archdiocese case in 2003 was that churches keep records, when they keep records, you get to see how they operate, and it was interesting to see situations in which people would report to the church authorities in the diocese that someone had been sexually abused, and the church would respond by sending a priest somewhere else. I had a specific case in Lynn where a priest from Lynn was sexually caught by a police officer, sexually abusing a boy. Police officers called a bishop from the Archdiocese of Boston. He came to the police station. He said, I'll take care of this. I'll make sure this priest never has access to kids again. moved him to a parish in Brighton, and I can identify at least three kids from that parish that he subsequently sexually abused, and I believe there were many more. Because that bishop was involved and because he's still alive, he can be sued personally, and he does not get the protection of the charitable immunity limit that is applied to the institution. So those cases get resolved because you're able to show that there's a supervisor who has liability.
And in terms of the public policy reasons for suing an institution or suing an individual, what does that accomplish?
Well, sad to say, particularly in the case of a church, you would expect them to always do the right thing because it is the right thing to do. But institutions take on a life of their own, not just the Catholic Church, but any institutions which do good things in our society. And we treat them better than other institutions. We give them tax breaks. We do all kinds of things for them. But in fact, what happens with many of them is they start to think that because the institution does good things, they have a different standard. And the protection of the institution becomes more important than protecting the individuals for whom they were established in the first place. So one of the things we've learned is that money motivates institutions to do the right things. And the Archdiocese of Boston, for example, paid $85 million to settle 552 cases in 2003. And since then, they have been attempting to change the way they did business at that time. They've adopted new procedures. The Boy Scouts, they were sued for many years. They had problems for many years, and they were sued. They instituted what they call a two-person rule. Now, no Boy Scout leader is allowed to be present with a child unless there's another adult present. You know, these are helpful things that protect kids from sexual abuse. They did not come about because the institution said, we have a problem, we've got to correct it. They came about because they were forced to do it because they were paying money.
Because of civil lawsuits filed.
That's right.
Now, another area that's held in very high esteem, obviously, is the medical profession. Is there sexual abuse within the medical profession of patients?
Well, regrettably, there is. I've had cases involving a Dr. Melvin Levine, who was one of the foremost experts on attention deficit disorder. I have personally spoken to over 100 people who said they were sexually abused by him. None of those 100 people know each other. And they all described sexual abuse by Dr. Levine in remarkably similar terms, and they could not have known how to do that unless it actually happened to them. To this day, Dr. Levine subsequently committed suicide when I filed a suit on behalf of about 50 people. But to this day, there are people that believe Dr. Levine never did anything. There was another doctor, a doctor named Daniel Gadjuzek. Dr. Gadjuzek also was at Children's Hospital and went to New Guinea, where he studied I'm not sure what he studied, but he studied something very important in the brain. And as a result of that, he received the Nobel Prize in Medicine. Brilliant man, obviously. Dr. Gadjuzek brought about 10 or 15 boys from New Guinea back to Maryland, where he was living at the time, and sexually abused them. Subsequently was prosecuted criminally, and admitted his guilt. Another doctor down in Connecticut was taking pictures, nude pictures of the boys that he had in a study. After his death, they found his house. They found something like 500 pictures in the walls of his house. And I can go on. You know, doctors, there is no the sad thing, Frank, there is no profession that you can name that doesn't have significant examples of sexual abuse occurring there. And, you know, there's a very simple reason for that. There was a bank robber. His name was Willie Sutton. And years ago, some reporters asked him, you know, Willie, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is. And this the answer is remarkably similar to what happens in youth-serving organizations. People who are interested in abusing kids are drawn to these organizations, and they have to be exceptionally vigilant to make sure that the kids in their charge don't get abused.
Now, what are the, I mean, it may seem obvious, but what are the harmful effects of sexual abuse in terms of the person? In other words, the person who's been abused, what do they typically go through in terms of treatment and everything else?
The short answer is their lives are destroyed. I can't tell you. My average client is a male in his 40s or 50s who comes to me, and I'm the first person he's ever told that he was abused. I'm probably the first guy he's ever cried in front of. A very, very large percentage of these people have alcohol or drug abuse and as part of their history. There's a American Medical Association study that says that if you start drinking before a certain age, then the odds that you will have a lifelong problem with alcohol is very, very high. And that's what you have. Some of it is the perpetrators are introducing kids to alcohol and drugs at a very young age. Some of it is that kids who might have experimented with alcohol and drugs and maybe not ended up with a problem, end up with it because they find that the alcohol or the drugs dull the effects of what they've been subjected to by the abusers. But, you know, the problems are lifelong problems. The problems of relationships are big. Only a very small percentage of people who are sexually abused will go on to abuse somebody else, but there is that small percentage who obviously become abusers for that reason.
Now, why do people first reveal this problem, you know, that they were abused at an older age, as opposed to, I mean, I've represented actually children who've been sexually abused, and it's typically a situation where the parents start with bedwetting when they're older. I mean, real weird behavioral problem. But why is it that someone who's older will come forward later on and not complain earlier on?
Well, first of all, some of the kids do complain. And part of the problem is that typically the abusers are people who are powerful. And being powerful, no one wants to believe that they've done anything bad.
When we return, we're going to continue on that thought, but we're going to talk about prevention. And Carmen is going to explain to all of us some of the problems with ways of preventing this type of problem.